Dr. James A. Simon is a D.C.-based physician providing patient-focused care for women across the reproductive life cycle, from adolescence to childbirth and through the menopause transition. He has served as principal investigator on more than 300 clinical trials, research grants, and scholarships in the area of women's health, with support from such noted institutions as the National Institutes of Health, the American Heart Association, and the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. Dr. Simon's work has been published extensively. We caught up with him at the ISHWISH 2020 annual meeting in Orlando, Florida.
It's with great honor that I'd like to start the 2020 annual ISHWISH meeting. This is my 10th year belonging to ISHWISH, and I'm grateful to belong to such a wonderful organization that has become my extended family. So I'd like anyone who is a new member to ISHWISH or a new attendee to either stand up or raise your hand. Okay, let's give them a round of hands. Look around. And let's welcome these individuals. So my hope for all of you newbies is that your experience with ISHWISH is a positive one and that you too can find your home within this society. If you're not already aware, we're going to have a new member and first-time attendee table outside. So at the break, make sure to go attend that. And you can also get to find out more about your new member or member benefits and how to utilize them. I'd also like to welcome. I'd also like you to come to the welcome reception this evening and join us for the Early Career Professionals Mixer tomorrow evening. I'd also like to thank everyone in the Scientific Program Committee and then the Education Committee under the direction of Tammy Rowan. Is Tammy out there at all? She's in the way back, but she did an awesome job with the education component. And I'm really grateful for all of these individuals that helped to plan such a wonderful meeting. And you can find all the names of the committee members if you look in your program book on the first page. All these committee members are very busy individuals, but they took a lot of time out of their lives to help plan the meeting and review abstracts. I'd also like to thank my scientific program chair, Linda Vignosi, who will be next year's scientific program chair. And I'd have her stand up and introduce her, but unfortunately, she lives in Italy, and she was not allowed to leave the country. So she's here in spirit, and I think that we have a picture of her. So that's us from last year. So she really would have liked to be here, but could not due to the coronavirus. Speaking of the coronavirus, as an international society, we have had a number of speakers who were not allowed to leave their respective countries at last minute due to the virus, but we have been able to have them embed some of their vocals into the slides, and we're going to have some of them call in. So I apologize that up until last week, everything was going smoothly, and then we had a number of speakers have to cancel because they weren't allowed to leave their country. So also trying to be mindful of everyone's health here at the conference, you may have gotten an email from me this morning. We're going to try to make this a handshake-free conference. And as a sexual health society, if you do feel like you want to shake someone's hand, please ask for consent. And hopefully, as a sexual health practitioners, you know how to do that. Also, I have a video that I was just made aware of yesterday. If you can play, I don't know if you can, okay. So this was, I don't know if you've ever heard of the Wuhan shake. So this is a way, if you want, another way to. And I had some people, is Brooke here as well? Yeah, so some of our board members that told me about it, they would like to demonstrate what that looks like as well. So if you're not sure how to do it, or so just so you know, that won't look weird over the weekend because everyone's going to be doing it. So I also wanted to let everyone know that yesterday the entire board went through an inclusion and diversity training. We're committed to inclusion and diversity, and we hope to improve diversity within our organization in the future. So please don't be afraid to provide us with feedback that you think would be helpful. We want everyone, and I mean everyone, to feel welcome and heard in this organization. I'd also like you to know that we have asked the hotel to create gender-neutral restrooms. They should be down the hall, and just please look for the signs on the hall that will say gender-neutral. I think they're that way. And then for those of you interested in continuing education credits, every participant will receive an email after the conference that asks them to complete a survey. Once they complete the survey, they will be able to access their continuing education certificate. I'd also like to, there was a number of people asking for Wi-Fi. So unfortunately, the conference room does not have Wi-Fi, so you will have to go to the lobby and then either use your room number or, Brooke, what was the other? Just use your room number to log in and then come back in and it should work. Okay, great. So if you put the word George, no capitals, that should work. And then lastly, I'd like to thank the exhibitors. Their financial support is what makes the society financially flourish. So if you can, during at least one of the breaks, if not more, if you could visit these exhibitors, that'd be wonderful. So thank you. Then I'm going to go right into introducing our president. So it's with great honor that I introduce our current president, Dr. Jim Simon, to deliver the Sandra Liebblum Presidential Lecture. Dr. Simon is a clinical professor of reproductive endocrinology and infertility in the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology at George Washington University. Dr. Simon maintains an active clinical practice, research practice in Washington, D.C. He's the past president of the North American Menopause Society and the Washington Gynecological Society. He has demonstrated a strong career-long commitment to the prevention of disease and advancing women's health. A short list of Dr. Simon's honors and achievements includes being selected to top Washington physicians, America's top obstetricians and gynecologists, Super Doctors of Washington, D.C., Baltimore, Northern Virginia, Doctor's Choice Awardee for Washington, D.C., and the Best Doctors in America. Dr. Simon is also the recipient of the Leon Spurroff, did I say that correctly? Okay, good. Outstanding Educator Award. He's also the author and co-author of more than 560 articles, which is kind of a lot. Abstracts, chapters, and proceedings, including several prize-winning chapters. And I have to let you know that he's also an amazing human being and individual. So I'm really honored to have him come up and give his presidential address.
Thank you very much, Rose. I really appreciate it. And we have a fantastic meeting in store for you. I'm really honored to be up here as perhaps my swan song. But I want to thank everyone before starting for the privilege and honor to serve as president of ISHWISH. It was really a joy to work with all of you and to put together conferences, meetings, educational seminars, and to really get the organization moving forward. So for that, thank you very, very much. The title of my talk is How the U.S. Government and the Media Conspired to Convince Women That Menopausal Hormone Therapy Was Dangerous. So let's start out with this. False facts are highly injurious to the progress of science, for they often endure long. And that was stated a long time ago by Charles Darwin. I'd like to offer special thanks to this rogues gallery of menopause and hormone experts. For the gynecologists in the audience, you may be familiar with many of them, but they are, in fact, the fathers, grandfathers, and children of those fathers of women's health and women's sexual health as seen from the hormonal point of view. And they've each contributed to both my education and to this talk. So thanks to all of them. I have a number of disclosures. And disclosures are, in fact, an important part of what I'm going to talk to you today about. And I have plenty of them. But the disclosures as it relates to public funding seldom are mentioned. If you have an NIH grant, if you have an NIH contract, if you're a WHI investigator, you have a conflict. You have a big conflict. You have a huge conflict in that you're not about to criticize the organization that is paying out literally billions of dollars a year to keep you funded, to keep your institution funded. And so when you see the data that I'm going to present to you today, maybe you need to ask yourself whether those conflicts are real, really real, or really, really real. The objectives of my talk are quite straightforward. At the end of this lecture, participants should be able to apply relevant data and not media hyperbole to educate patients and their fellow practitioners, guiding them through menopausal hormone therapy decision making. Second, to understand that spin and alternative facts are pervasive and that the NIH, WHI, and FDA are not immune and may be the most egregious offenders. I'd like you to appreciate that the mainstream media, that is to say broadcast, print, and social, have been lazy at best, complicit and irresponsible at worst in reporting the risks and benefits of menopausal hormone therapy, and I hope you'll have a better appreciation of and appropriate context for the true risks of menopausal hormone therapy. So as to be completely transparent, and if you don't know what the word egregious means, it means outstandingly bad. If you don't know what the word spin means, it's a noun but can also be used as a verb. It's a description or the act of describing negative events in an overly favorable way. So let's look at the U.S. government.
On the morning of July 9th, 2002, the National Institute of Health called a full-blown press conference at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. to make an announcement about the WHI study.
Good morning. First, women should not start or continue this therapy to prevent heart disease. The findings show it doesn't work. In fact, the therapy increases the risk for a heart attack or stroke. Additionally, it increases the risk for breast cancer and for blood clots.
And then, to make sure the word got out, sent experts and officials to hit the morning and evening news circuit. Their message was completely unexpected and was shocking.
Whoever heard of an NIH multi-center contract announcing the results in a press conference? This is the government. And they announced very strikingly that there was an increased risk of breast cancer, which was the stopping parameter by which they stopped this billion-dollar federally funded study. That press release came out officially on July the 9th, but there was an embargo in place from July the 8th, which the Detroit Free Press decided to break. So the Detroit Free Press told the story the evening of July the 8th. Everybody else got the word out on July the 9th, and we, the scientific and medical public, didn't receive our issue of JAMA, in which the scientific information was published, until July 17th. And remember, that was before the widely used internet dispensed and distributed information very quickly. Clinicians felt betrayed, and science was subverted via the press by representing, that is, misrepresenting findings that played upon women's greatest fears, the fear of breast cancer. And I will tell you that one of my mentors, Dr. Leon Spiroff, in discussing hormone therapy said, What are the risks of hormone therapy in the eyes of women? Breast cancer, and maybe number 10, deep vein thrombosis. By having the information distributed in the news, in the broader media, and sending out their own emissaries to give lectures and talks and interviews, the NIH controlled the message. The scientific paper that turned menopause and hormone therapy and our world, those of us who practice menopausal women, upside down, was accepted and put into galleys before being shown to the clinical center principal investigators. If you do clinical research for a pharmaceutical company, they cannot submit it for publication unless each and every investigator signs off on it. Oftentimes a problem. The paper, as it was to be published, was shown to the full group of principal investigators for the very first time at their semi-annual meeting in Chicago, approximately 10 days before the planned press release. The paper largely abandoned the pre-specified analysis plans, that were enunciated and determined before the first patient was enrolled into the clinical trials, and therefore the stage was set for abandoning other key elements of the protocol, which, by the way, was published. Concerns regarding the approach and content from some of the principal investigators was addressed by a promise to incorporate their modest changes into the final version of the article, and those investigators quickly drafted those changes in that morning. But the changes became moot as the JAMA issue had already been printed and was sitting in a warehouse waiting to be distributed with the inflammatory headline and press release that you've already seen and heard.
And Dr. Nancy Snyderman is NBC's chief medical editor. Nancy, good morning.
Hi, Meredith.
Bottom line now, when it comes to hormone replacement therapy, if you're taking it, get off it?
Yeah, you have to talk to your doctor. Get off cold turkey, taper. But if you have already gone through menopause and you think you're going to stay on these things till you drop dead, you may be swapping one problem for another. There is a cause and effect. There is proof that breast cancer rates go up. It doesn't make sense to stay on hormones.
So there's no question in your mind that that this correlation is accurate?
There's no question in my mind.
There are other natural remedies, these bioidenticals on the market that a lot of women are saying, well, I'm not going to go on the hormone replacement therapy. I'll get this natural product instead.
This is like saying, I don't want to eat too much ice cream, but you go ahead and have your chocolate and I'll have vanilla. Hormones are hormones, no matter what we call them. So whether you buy them from a traditional pharmaceutical company or you get them made up in another pharmacy, hormones after menopause still give you artificially raised levels of hormones that are not supposed to simulate when you were 22. They don't make your bones stronger. They don't make your heart better. They don't make you smarter. They don't make your skin better. But they do cause disease. So I think this is a time to say, hey, look, menopause is not an illness. You don't have to treat it. You don't have to cure it. It's a rite of passage in one's life. If you need a short stint to help get through hot flashes, talk to your doctor about it. But do not think these little pills should be popped forever and ever and ever. It doesn't make sense. It's not safe. There is an absolute link to breast cancer.
In other words, it can kill you.
Absolutely. I took my mother off of them years ago. I wouldn't go near them, and you shouldn't either.
Dr. Nancy Snyderman, thank you.
You're welcome,
so
Meredith.
Some 3 to 4 million women saw that on TV that morning.
And Dr. Nancy's.
Oh, and by the way, Dr. Snyderman is a board-certified ear, nose, and throat specialist. You heard all kinds of stuff. If you're taking it. Get off cold turkey, taper. It doesn't make your bones stronger. That's not true. It doesn't make your heart better. I'll show you that it does. It doesn't make you smarter. I don't have time to go into that, but it does. And it doesn't make your skin better. I don't have time to go into it, but it does. And it does cause disease. Yes, it causes endometrial cancer, which is highly curable. But the media was all over it. They could not get enough. They could not nearly get enough. And in fact, the WHI had such enormous media coverage, more than 400 newspapers and 2,500 television and radio stories, that it even got its own paper in the Annals of Internal Medicine, not talking about the study or its results, talking about the news media. Now, how many pages are devoted in academic journals to talking about the news media about a paper? You think about it. There were some problems. They sent out warning letters during the study, which changed the content of the individuals in the study. Okay? If I'm doing a research project and you're my group of patients that are waiting to enroll in my study, and someone comes up to me and asks me, Dr. Simon, I heard this experimental medication you're using causes death and breast cancer, and then my office staff yells it out on the whole place. Yeah, it does. How many of you are still in the audience waiting to enroll in my study? It's not happening. Not only that, but if you're already in, you're saying, I think I'm going to get off this, even if it's a placebo-controlled trial. And by the way, the NIH sent out several warning letters during the course of the study, inadvertently, in my opinion, unblinding the study itself. So why the WHI? Why am I picking on this study? Well, because it's cost us $1 billion for a single study on hormone therapy, but on other things too, which I don't have time to go into. Why was it done? Why did our government spend $1 billion on the single most important, arguably, study in women's health and hormonal menopausal health? Well, it's because heart disease is the number one killer of women. And even though women believe, and they truly believe, that breast cancer is the number one killer of women, the truth is that it's heart disease. Tenfold more women die of heart disease than die of breast cancer every year. And there was abundant literature from observational studies showing that the risk of cardiovascular disease with either estrogen therapy in the squares or hormone therapy, estrogen and progestogen, in the circles reduced the risk of coronary vascular disease. With the exception of this one study, all of these other studies suggest, that is to say, not significantly, but suggest a reduced risk of coronary vascular disease. And some of the biggest, most recent studies show a statistically significant reduction in the risk of coronary vascular disease with hormones or estrogen therapy. But there are inherent biases in observational studies. Healthier women tend to volunteer. That's a selection bias. We monitor them closely because we want to know what's happening to them. If they've been prescribed hormones, we want to make sure they're not having an adverse event. So that's prevention bias. Patients with greater adherence, even to placebo in placebo-controlled trials, have better outcomes. We call that compliance bias, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And all of those studies I showed you, those are all observational studies. Observational studies. Well, out of that grew the Women's Health Initiative, a single large study that the late Bernadine Healy, who went to Congress and got special money set aside to do, which established the Women's Health Initiative in 1991, went about a number of studies. The two most important, in my opinion, were estrogen and estrogen progestin, and the first arm of that study, the estrogen progestin arm, was halted prematurely after 5.3 years of treatment in July of 2002, as I've shown you. There was an estrogen-only part of the study that came out about 2 years later, but nobody heard about it, and that's a problem in and of itself. This doesn't look like an important slide, but it's one of the most important slides I'll show you. It's published by the WHI in the methods section where it defined the outcomes of these trials. The primary outcome was coronary heart disease. This is postmenopausal hormone therapy right there, a line of all the outcomes. And the only one that has a number one after it is coronary heart disease. That means everything else, including breast cancer, was a secondary outcome, which means it's no more valid or less valid than an observational study. Because for the primary outcome, in a randomized placebo-controlled trial, we randomize based on the risk of that person when they come into the study. And that was done here. In the WHI, women who are at higher risk for heart disease went in one group, and the next one at higher risk went in the other group, and everybody at high risk was evenly divided, everybody at low risk was evenly divided for heart disease. But they weren't randomized for any of the secondary outcomes, including breast cancer. So think about it this way. If I'm doing a study investigating a brand new drug for weight loss, but I had a number of people in the study that had bypass surgery, gastric bypass surgery, and I let them in, and I didn't put them evenly in the two groups, how fair would the evaluation be of my new drug, Super X? Well, if all the bypass patients went in one study, one part of the study, either the placebo group or the active treatment, it would unbalance the study, and the study wouldn't be valid. Well, Mark Twain said it best, there are three kinds of lies. Lies, damned lies, and statistics. So permit me a minute to talk about statistics. Remember, I told you the primary endpoint of a randomized clinical trial is the highest level of evidence in this pyramid. A major secondary endpoint in a randomized clinical trial is below that in importance and potentially suffers from all the biases inherent in observational studies, which I already showed you. Everything else, including down here off the bottom of the chart, expert opinion, are of lower importance and lower scientific value. All right, this is the nitty-gritty, guys. Pay attention. This is what we call a forest plot. Even for those of you with statistical backgrounds, don't know it's also called a blobogram. It's a graphical display of results from a number of scientific studies addressing the same question. Forest plots are commonly used to present data, and they're commonly displayed in two columns. Here's one column, and here's another column. The first column, or the left-hand column, is called chronological order of the various studies that we're looking at, typically shown from the oldest to the newest. And that's what's seen here. The other, the right-hand column, is a plot of the results of those various studies displayed as a measure of the effect. Okay? The measure of the effect, whatever the intervention. Here the intervention is estrogen replacement therapy. And if something is one of these boxes is over here to the right of the vertical line, an important thing. That vertical line, the vertical line is the line of the no harm, no foul line, no effect line. No treatment effect line, okay? So if it's to this side, It means that whatever it was increased the risk, in this case, of breast cancer. And if it's to the left of the line, it's decreased the risk of breast cancer. And if you look at the bottom, it tells you how much it's increased or how much it's decreased. So something that's out here at 2 means that whatever the treatment, estrogen therapy, doubled the risk of breast cancer. And if it's at 0.5, it's halved the risk of breast cancer. And what you see is it's not clear. There are studies all over the place. Now, you should also know the bigger the box, the bigger the study, the more people it represents. And if you look with a little Vaseline on your glasses, you see that the bigger the studies, the closer they are to that vertical line of no harm, no foul. Here's another forest plot. This one looks a little different. These are studies of breast cancer mortality in women who were discovered to have breast cancer while they were on hormone therapy. And in this case, all of the boxes are to the reduced risk side of the vertical no harm, no foul line. Some are statistically significant because their little wings, whiskers, or whatever hanging off the sides do not overlap the no harm, no foul line. If a study, whether it's to the left or to the right, has a confidence interval or a hazard ratio that overlaps the no harm, no foul line, it doesn't matter whether it's to the left of the line or the right of the line, it means it's not statistically significantly different than chance alone that it did whatever you're looking at, in this case, breast cancer mortality. Remember that. It's really important that if the whiskers or the confidence interval overlaps the no harm, no foul line, the study didn't tell us anything. It could have happened by chance alone. Next concept. We call it the zombie idea. A zombie idea is an idea that should have been killed by the evidence, but simply refuses to die. It keeps coming back. It refuses to die. And it was coined by Paul Krugman, a Nobel Prize winner in economics, about an economic issue, not about estrogen or hormone therapy and breast cancer, but it's equally applicable there. So now, if you're still not sure which side is up and which side is down, let's look at some data. These are the results of the estrogen progestin arm of the Women's Health Initiative, first reported on July 9, 2002. And they were reported for heart disease, breast cancer, stroke, venous thromboembolism, colorectal cancer, hip fractures, total fractures. New onset diabetes came out somewhat later. But you can see they expressed it both as a confidence interval, which we know has to not overlap one. That's the no harm, no foul line. And they also expressed it as risk per 10,000 women per year or benefit per 10,000 women per year. And you can see that there were about 7 extra heart attacks, 8 extra breast cancers, 7 extra strokes, 18 extra venous thromboemboli per 10,000 women per year. But you still don't know if that's a real increase or a bad luck of the draw. Similarly, there were some benefits. We hardly ever hear about them, but 7 fewer colorectal cancers, 5 fewer hip fractures, almost 50 fewer total fractures. Are they significant? Well, it depends whether you look at the nominal confidence interval, which means it must be a primary outcome. If it's not a primary outcome, you have to adjust for their baseline risks because they're unequal. Some people had gastric bypass. And you can see that they changed their mind. And the revised data shows that even for the nominal confidence interval for coronary heart disease, that overlapped one, touched one, and therefore was not statistically significant. But remember, it was the primary outcome. And they had a choice. For breast cancer, their pre-specified choice was an adjusted confidence interval, but that was not going to deter them from changing their mind, and so they used the nominal confidence interval against their pre-specified analysis plan and against what the investigators had agreed to prove, in my opinion, that hormones increased, albeit very slightly, 8 extra cases of breast cancer per 10,000 women per year. Estrogen alone, the results look very different. This came out 2 years later. Remember, these are all women about age 64 on average. There were some benefits. In this case, heart disease was reduced. Breast cancer was reduced. I'm sorry. Did you say breast cancer was reduced with estrogen? I did. And so did the WHI. Oh my God, I never heard that. There was an increase in strokes, venous thromboemboli, pulmonary emboli, colorectal cancer, and yet another big decrease in fractures. In women 50 to 59, those who were most likely to be taking hormones before the WHI, since the WHI, right now, the risks were even smaller. But how big or how small are those risks? Remember, I showed you the risks in the WHI showing an increase in breast cancer, they were 8 extra cases per 10,000 women per year. Is that a lot? Is that a little? What do you think? How many of you have a credit card? Everybody. If you don't have a credit card, it's because your credit is too bad. Well, if you look, what you can see is that your risk of identity theft by owning a credit card in 2010 was 8 per 10,000. About the risk, the worst case scenario of women who might have had breast cancer due to hormones in the Women's Health Initiative. But I'm going to show you that isn't even true. The more credit cards you have, the more risk you have. Well, regardless, with this news coming out, the use of hormone therapy, whether it be in women who had hysterectomy and did not have a uterus, or women who used hormones after a natural menopause, the use of hormone therapy went down dramatically. We often forget there are about 4 times as many women who had hysterectomies who are on hormones and on estrogen alone, with a totally different pattern of risk and benefits, than the women on estrogen and progestin. But it's all about breast cancer. Everybody knows that hormones increase your risk of breast cancer. True? No. How many of you know that hormones for decades, estrogen in particular, were used to treat breast cancer? I can't make that up. So here's a fungating, horrible breast cancer in 1944, treated with estrogen, nearly went away. 1973, another horrible breast cancer, treated with estrogen, went away. Patient died of coronary heart disease 8 years later. Here's a woman that has breast cancer mets in her lungs. Treated with estrogen, mets went away. And my favorite of all time, maybe my favorite study ever, and I read a lot, is this randomized controlled trial of tamoxifen versus a very potent synthetic estrogen, DES, which all the gynecologists know can cause clear cell carcinoma in the next generation of women if moms took it for presumptive miscarriage. Think about that. We gave this to pregnant women. How risky could it have been to prevent miscarriage? Well, here's a randomized trial showing that it works equally well at preventing breast cancer as tamoxifen. Tamoxifen, the gold standard now for preventing breast cancer or breast cancer recurrence in pre- and postmenopausal women, equally well. How did we end up with tamoxifen? Why didn't we end up with DES? Two reasons, in my opinion. DES was off patent. It's a big deal. And tamoxifen did not result in bleeding. And there's nothing that a medical oncologist hates more than vaginal bleeding. But even modern times, 2009, estradiol, 6 milligrams daily, was used to prevent recurrence and make breast cancer sensitive to treatment. That's not that old. That's even after the WHI. Think about trying to get that protocol through your local IRB. And what about breast cancer recurrence? I'll bet there's no one in this audience that believes a woman with diagnosed breast cancer, after her treatment with tamoxifen and aromatase inhibitor, etc., who is disease-free. We never say cured in breast cancer. We say disease-free. Could she take hormone therapy? Oh, no, it'll make her cancer come back. It's not true. Here's the world's literature looking at recurrence risk. There are three studies, 1, 2, 3, that show a decreased risk of recurrence in women who took hormones or estrogen following their breast cancer. There's one study that showed an increased risk. One study in the whole world's literature, the overwhelming number of studies show no difference whatsoever. Well, there's lots of things that increase or decrease your risk of breast cancer. Grapefruit can both reduce your risk of breast cancer and increase your risk of breast cancer. I kid you not. So everything above this line shows a reduction in risk because the relative risk is less than one, and everything below the line shows the relative risk that's increased, and therefore eating French fries once a week in preschool increases your breast cancer risk. Actually more than estrogen and progestin in the WHI. Please don't take away my French fries. Let's look at comparison between tobacco smoking and lung cancer. That increased risk is 26. Anybody on an electric blanket? Your risk of increased breast cancer is almost 5. Don't ask me the mechanism. So the methods are very important. Let's look at breast cancer, a secondary outcome in the WHI. And here's the paper. It shows, and I expect you to read that. I'll blow it up for you. It says, relatively short-term combined estrogen plus progestin use increases incident breast cancers. It's from the Women's Health Initiative, what I've been calling the WHI, randomized trial. It's a lie to even call it a randomized trial, because it wasn't randomized for breast cancer. It was randomized for cardiovascular disease. So you can say the WHI was a randomized trial, but in a subset of randomized patients who were not randomized, this is what happened. It says right here that it increased the risk of breast cancer, but if you look at the data, this is what they used. The hazard ratio was that one I showed you, just a little bit above one, but the pre-specified, a priori defined statistic before they enrolled their first patient was to use the multivariate adjusted analysis, and it goes from 0.97 to 1.5, overlapping the no harm, no foul line. Even the WHI tells us that hormones didn't increase the risk of breast cancer when they analyzed it correctly as an observational secondary outcome. They weren't done. They told us about it again, about 5 years later. Same data, same study. Estrogen plus progestin was associated with a greater breast cancer incidence. I don't know why they felt compelled to say it again, but they did. But if you look at the data, the hazard ratio of breast cancer incidence, that's what they just said they looked at, it overlaps 1.98 to 1.37. But they gave us a key to what was going on. That was different when compared to the hazard ratio for women with a prior combined hormone therapy use. Now they're telling us that those risks were not balanced at baseline. Then they really came clean in an obscure journal called Maturitas. I read it. But it's the European Menopause and Andropause Society official journal. It's not JAMA. Let's look at the data, and that was published, by the way, 2006. In that study, the hazard ratio and 95% confidence interval is this. It's a no harm, no foul risk of breast cancer from hormones because it was adjusted for age, race, body mass index, physical activity, smoking, alcohol use, parity, oral contraceptives, family history, etc. Those are all risks. That's how they tried to make it balanced. And this is what the data looks like. In women who had no prior hormone use, the estrogen progestin arm, which is in blue, was identical to the placebo arm, which was in pink. All of the risk came from women who had any prior hormone use. So let you be the scientist.
One of these things is not like the others. One of these things doesn't belong. Can you tell which thing is not like the other by the time I finish this song?
The average Sesame Street viewer is between 3 and 4 years of age. Here's the same data. Let's move this line, that's estrogen progestin use with prior hormone use, onto the other graph. It's identical. Let's move the placebo group, the one that is not like the others, into the same place, and it's different. So even if you like this analysis, the worst thing you can say is prior hormone use reduces your risk of breast cancer. You cannot say hormone use increases your risk of breast cancer because all three of those lines are identical and equal to placebo. And you know what? Unfortunately, they told us the same thing all the way back in July of 2002 when they reported, and this table comes directly from this initial publication, where women who had no prior hormone use, 12,304 of them out of 16,608, had no statistically significant increase in breast cancer. The no harm, no foul line is right there. All of the risk came from women who had used hormones before. And it was assumed that prior use of hormones was increasing the risk, not decreasing the risk.
From NBC News, this is Today.
Breast cancer plunged. The rate of the disease drops dramatically just a year after millions of women were warned not to take hormone replacement therapy. What does that mean for you? Now to what could be the biggest breakthrough yet in the fight against breast cancer. The number of women diagnosed with the disease dropped dramatically in the year after millions were warned to stop taking hormone pills. One doctor says the news is better than a cure. We get more now from NBC's chief science correspondent, Robert Bazell.
It was the biggest news ever in women's health.
It increases the risk for breast cancer and for blood clots.
In 2002, the government abruptly stopped the study of hormone replacement therapy for postmenopausal women when it revealed an increased risk for breast cancer. Almost overnight, some 15 million women stopped taking the hormones. Many people thought it was an overreaction, but the latest study shows otherwise. In the year after all those women stopped taking hormones, the incidence of breast cancer, which had been steadily rising, suddenly dropped by an unprecedented 7%. Dr. Donald Berry of MD Anderson Cancer Center studies cancer incidence.
That was my first surprise. How could it happen so rapidly?
Dr. Berry and his team showed that most of the decrease was in postmenopausal women, and it was the particular kind of breast cancer that is fueled by the female hormone estrogen.
So they're fed by hormones, and if you stop the feeding, if you stop the fuel, you stop the growth.
Many doctors now advise that women can take the hormones for short periods to treat the symptoms of menopause. But experts say these latest numbers should erase any doubt that long-term hormone use leads to increased risk for breast cancer.
Now you're going to get as close to this as you can.
For today, Robert Bazell, NBC News, New York.
So here's what they're talking about. 2002 to 2003, 7% decrease from that bar to that bar. This is from the CDC, okay? That's what they're reporting on. This is what actually happened. 22% of women quit their hormones down to about 12%, and that resulted in a 7% decrease in breast cancer. But then women stopped even more and more and more. By 2012, 79% of women had stopped their hormone therapy, but breast cancer risk went up. How does that work? What did I miss? Mr. Lauer, Dr. Berry, I know you can both read. You neglected to read this paper that was published beforehand. It says, it's very important to note that the incidence and mortality data in the 2003 report will be age-adjusted to the 2000 population standard of the United States. This change in method will affect the comparability of the new report's data with that of previous years. Now, I can read that, but I'm not on national news. Maybe Gloria Borger, who is the chief political analyst for CNN, said it best. She said, for most folks, no news is good news, but for the press, good news is not news. And I found that as a quote in this paper, peer-reviewed paper, looking at media coverage of women's health issues. Is there a bias in the reporting of an association between hormone replacement therapy and breast cancer? Published before the WHI, showing the answer is yes. And the bias is hormones cause breast cancer. Well, there's tons of other examples. This is from the Associated Press. Study links estrogen and breast cancer. That sounds pretty horrible. That's what they're talking about. But if you read it, women who take estrogen-only pills for at least 15 years run a markedly higher risk of breast cancer, according to a study. But there was no increase in hormone therapy if they took it only for 10 years. Would it surprise you that the average use of hormone therapy before the WHI was less than 2 years? That only 8% of women used it for 5 years? But the answer is, this looks horrible, and this looks to me very reassuring. There are tons of media reports. I won't go through them because I need to show you more, much scarier stuff. But it was all over the news. Every single news agency, the Sun-Times, Reuters, USA Today, the Boston Globe, AP, LA Times, ABC News, Reuters, the New York Times, and the Wall Street Journal, all said there was a relationship between hormones and breast cancer, and it was bad. Then the New York Times reported on the benefits of estrogen-only therapy, demonstrating a statistically significant 20 and 33% drop in the risk of breast cancer with estrogen by itself, published in 2004 and again in 2006. But nobody heard about it. And they didn't help because the headline in the New York Times was, health risks to older women seen with hormone therapy, in which they reported an increased risk of breast cancer with estrogen only. Only 2 days later, to correct it deep in the bowels of the New York Times, where they said, oops, it did not also increase the risk of breast cancer. And I caught this because Gina Colata was a co-author on the book Sex in America. Gina, you should know better. So let's look at this really carefully. Here's the estrogen-only arm, estrogen by itself. Here's the Ruth trial. This is raloxifene. Raloxifene is an FDA-approved product, FDA-approved to reduce fractures, and FDA-approved to reduce breast cancer risk. We have two studies, one with 10,700, one with 10,000 women, mean age 63, mean age 67, 6.8 years of treatment, 5.6 years of treatment, and the risk of heart disease are similar, the risks of stroke are similar, the risk of venous thromboembolism lower with estrogen than raloxifene, the risk of pulmonary embolism and DVT similar, and interestingly, the risk of breast cancer, the reduced risk of breast cancer, identical, and estrogen-reduced fractures a lot better. But this is the drug approved for reduction in breast cancer and fractures. Estrogen not. Ovarian cancer is a very bad disease. Ovarian cancer kills about 14,000 women in the U.S., and it is the fifth greatest cause of cancer deaths after lung and bronchus, breast, colorectal, pancreas. It was a secondary outcome, ovarian cancer, in the Women's Health Initiative. And this study, very important study, published in JAMA in 2003, I think it is, says, and I quote, "This randomized trial," again, it wasn't randomized for ovarian cancer, "suggests that continuous combined estrogen plus progestin therapy may increase the risk of ovarian cancer." May increase the risk of ovarian cancer. Hormone therapy increases the risk of ovarian cancer. That is terrifying. Let's look. Here's what they're talking about. This is may increase, and you see these two lines, and they look different, right? And the top line is the risk from estrogen and progestin, and the bottom line is placebo, and they're supposed to be different because hormones increase your risk of ovarian cancer. But if you look at the fine print says it doesn't make any difference when you adjust for baseline risk, as you know you should, in a secondary or observational trial, those lines are not different. And we took them to task. See the hazard ratio here? It overlaps 1.59 to 4.3. That's the no harm, no foul. Doesn't matter. When we wrote a letter to the editor, the authors came back and said, "We agree." Well, why didn't you put it in your damn paper?
Oh, that's very different. Never mind.
Unfortunately, Dr. Gilda Radner died from ovarian cancer. So let's look really quickly at the primary outcome. Coronary heart disease, the primary outcome. Did hormone therapy, estrogen and progestin, reduce the risk of heart attacks? It says, for women less than 10 years since menopause, the hazard ratio for coronary heart disease was 0.76, trending toward lower. That's about a 34% reduction. But the confidence interval overlapped 1, right there. For older women, it didn't look quite so good, and their conclusion was women who initiated hormone therapy closer to menopause tended to have reduced coronary heart disease risk compared to the increase in coronary heart disease risk among women more distant from menopause, But this trend did not meet our criterion for statistical significance. Everybody in this audience knows or should know that the standard parameter for statistical significance is p less than 0.05. P less than 0.05. So I read this and I said, our criteria? Who are you? We got a lot of hours here. So looking at it, they said, and this is in the study, they said statistical tests were undertaken at the 0.01 level to partially account for multiple testing. You said you were going to use 0.05 before the first patient was enrolled. You can't change. It's a critical error. It should never have been published, or you should use the analysis plan that you said you were going to use.
I think you all know that I've always felt the 9 most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
And the FDA jumped right on all the hormone therapy data, and in spite of the fact that women suffer from vaginal atrophy and pain with sex, and it ruins marriages, and it ruins their lives, and it affects their risk of urinary incontinence, and affects their risk of urinary tract infections, and it's highly underdiagnosed and undertreated, the WHI caused there to be class labeling. By the way, it also causes depression and anxiety. Class labeling on all hormone therapy products, regardless of how low the estrogen dose is, and it all went down. It says, and I quote, this is the package insert from a 10 microgram vaginal insert. It says, endometrial cancer, stroke, deep vein thrombosis, probable dementia, DVT, pulmonary embolism, myocardial infarction, invasive breast cancer, and, again, probable dementia. Now, who wants to put that in their vagina? I don't want even in the same room with me. Well, NAMS and Ishwish went to the FDA and said, guys, this is wrong. You need to change that label. And we wrote a citizen's petition to the FDA that was sent to them shortly around November of 2015. They got around to answering us in May of 2018. What if you sent an email and somebody answered you 3 years later? And they took 30 pages, actually it's only 23, I'm exaggerating, to say no, they don't want to change the label. And this, ironically, is in spite of a large observational study from the WHI looking at women who used vaginal estrogen with or without a hysterectomy. And I know you can't read all this, but you can see that there's nothing to the right of the no harm, no foul line, except this, which is not statistically significant. So breast cancer's on there, endometrial cancer's on there, all the other things you worry about. The WHI actually told the FDA it doesn't matter if you put 10 micrograms of estrogen in your vagina in terms of risk. And we have lots of drugs. I won't go into them. They're all safe and effective by virtue of the FDA. And nearly all of them have warnings on them that say heart attack, stroke, dementia, and breast cancer. It's goofy. Think about this. The gynecologists know this is the total dose over an entire year using 4 micrograms of the FDA-approved drug Imvexxy. An entire year's worth is less than a half a milligram. That's what we give by mouth every day or more. That breast cancer case, they give 6 milligrams a day. So one other thing, because if hormones are bad for you, well, maybe your energy-based devices are better, specifically for breast cancer survivors who have a fear in spite of what I showed you, for the use of any estrogen, because the label says it's going to give them breast cancer again. And there are a number of studies, this on fractional lasers, that show that vaginal elasticity improves, dilator penetration improves, FSFI improves, etc., etc., etc. But not to be done, the FDA cracked down on all the manufacturers of lasers in July 30th of 2018 and said that they were dangerous. Dangerous. Well, let's look at safety. There have been over 200,000 vaginal laser treatments in the U.S. This was the best I could do. A handful of cases, about 50 presumed complications, 30 reported adverse events, and no claims in the Bloomberg data law base. So a few handfuls out of a half a million or so laser treatments, but in spite of that, sales of lasers tanked, and breast cancer survivors now find themselves with nothing to treat their vulvovaginal atrophy and dyspareunia. Well, in conclusion, I'd like to show you that life has an irony, and even the WHI can change their minds. In July of 2002, they said the substantial risk for cardiovascular disease and breast cancer. Just a year later, they said the suggestion of a slight overall increase in the risk of coronary heart disease. And by 2007, they said with no apparent increase in coronary heart disease risk for women close to menopause, and total mortality was reduced among women 50 to 59 years of age. 2016, in the estrogen-only arm, they said estrogen alone significantly reduced breast cancer incidence in postmenopausal black women. Well, if I were a black woman, I'd want to know that. No adverse influence on coronary heart disease, venous thromboembolism, or all-cause mortality. And finally, in 2017, hormone therapy was not associated with a risk of all-cause, cardiovascular, or cancer mortality during 18 years of follow-up. There are a number of studies all showing that the no harm, no foul line was not crossed for estrogen, 80% reduction in breast cancer, ductal carcinoma, in long-term follow-up, all statistically and significantly reduced breast cancer risk with estrogen. And even the WHI, finally, 2017, came around and said in the pooled trials of estrogen and progestin and estrogen, there was a reduction in all-cause mortality 50 to 59 years of age. My favorite trial in the whole world, the Finnish trial, more than nearly 500,000 Finnish women, all looking at their impact of hormone therapy, and it shows that whether it's estrogen alone, estrogen progestin, or any hormone therapy, the hazard ratio and the confidence intervals, all statistically significant and all show a reduction in risk, in this case of death. It doesn't matter whether you start when you're 50 to 54 or greater than age 80, you have a reduction in your risk of death. And if you're a surgically menopausal woman and you don't take hormone therapy, this analysis shows that nearly 50,000 women died prematurely because they didn't take hormones. So what happened to women over the United States during the course, after and before the WHI? Men are on top. This looks at the change in overall mortality. Substantial improvement is in blue, minimal improvement in teal, worsening in red. Not very much red for us men, but before and after the WHI, look with your eyes open. So if your patients are getting mixed signals about hormone therapy, why wouldn't they? This is in response to a 2008 publication from the WHI. The Wall Street Journal says cancer risk rises. The Chicago Sun-Times say hormones lessen risk after time, and the New York Times say it remains about the same. That's all for the same study. So in conclusion, I'd like to say an increased risk of breast cancer detection is not the same as breast cancer mortality or causality. Compared with placebo, the risks associated with hormone therapy in early menopausal women are statistically non-significant, less than 1 in 1,000 women per treatment year of therapy. The magnitude and type of risks associated with hormones are less than, similar to, other commonly used medication supplements and therapies. Hormone therapy reduces all-cause mortality, coronary heart disease, fractures, new-onset diabetes, and thus benefits far outweigh the risk in early menopausal women. The scientific truth does not triumph by convincing its opponents and making them see the light, but rather because its opponents eventually die, and a new generation grows up that's familiar with it.
Here's to the crazy ones, the misfits, the rebels, the troublemakers, the round pegs in the square holes, the ones who see things differently. They're not fond of rules, and they have no respect for the status quo. You can quote them, disagree with them, glorify or vilify them. About the only thing you can't do is ignore them. Because they change things. They push the human race forward. While some may see them as the crazy ones, we see genius. Because the people who are crazy enough to think they can change the world are the ones who do.
Thank you.